Welcome to the Centre for Public Integrity's podcast series. The Centre is Australia's leading democracy research institute. In these podcasts, we aim to bring listeners with us as we explore with key decision makers and policy designers just how our democracy works. I'm Michael Barker, former federal court judge and a director at the Centre. And today I'm very pleased to welcome to the podcast Bridget Archer, member for the seat of Bass in Tasmania in the federal parliament. Welcome, Bridget.
Hello, Michael. Nice to join you.
Bridget, when I was younger than I am now, I was trying to work back to when it was, the seat of Bass was always called the bellwether seat. Whoever won Bass seemed to have the purse strings in Canberra. But that's no longer the case by the look of it.
Well, it has been called other things, like the ejector seat of federal politics as well. It's certainly been, it has developed a reputation, certainly in the last 30 years, of being a fairly volatile seat. And I held the seat at the last election. I think that's the first time it had been held consecutively in 20 years. So, yeah, it's a volatile seat, has been for some time.
Bridget, you have a lovely, relatively simple and communicates a very direct message on your homepage. And I was intrigued to see how much that represents a different approach to politics, I suppose, in the modern world. Your logo, in a sense, is representing our community. And then you quoted it as saying, "From the moment I was elected, I have committed to being a genuine and authentic representative for Northern Tasmanian community." As I say, it's very direct, it's very clear. Was that a different sort of philosophy that you were promoting that others before you had promoted?
I'm not sure. It was just something that really, and remains actually very important to me. It was a commitment I made in my first speech in the parliament that I really wanted to represent the community that I had that had elected me, that I was drawn from, rather than, I think, bringing the Canberra's view, if you like, and trying to sort of impose that on my constituency, which I think is something we've seen, a bit of, I suppose, as an emerging issue that people feel, at least. I don't know how accurate it might be, but I think there's that feeling that, if you just say the same thing often enough to the constituency that they might believe it, rather than sort of going and listening to what they say and then bringing that here. And I think that's something that I think is important. I've also come out of local government, and we often hear, the level of government closest to the people. I think that's partly true, but I don't think it has to be true. And I think that anybody that is seeking election to any level of elected office shouldn't be sort of a protected species. You should be accessible and accountable to the people that you're asking to represent. And I think sometimes that means that you show up for hard conversations, difficult conversations sometimes, as well as just the good stuff and the good announcements and what have you.
Bridget, you've famously crossed the floor on a number of issues plainly important to you, some big policy items, including the National Anti-Corruption Commission legislation. When you're in a party, it must be very difficult to do that. So you have to have clear philosophies about how, well, the democratic process, about how the governmental process works. Can you tell me a little about that?
Yeah, I think fundamentally it comes back to the notion that we just talked about, which is, at one level it is one reason why I chose to join the Liberal Party, because I think it does have a philosophy in theory that supports members' ability to vote according to their conscience, I suppose. And I think that accords with those values that I was talking about in terms of being able to represent your constituency. Now, to me, that's always meant that if I do a good job of representing my constituents, then I get to have the benefit, I guess, of continuing to represent my party. I don't know that that necessarily holds true. If you do a good job representing your party, are you necessarily going to always be doing what's in the best interests of your constituency? And I think that's where we can kind of get lost along the way. To me, it's very simple to say, well, my job as an elected representative is to do the best I can for the community that sent me here. Now, I happen to be a member of a party, and that comes with it, you know, I think things that to me are important functions of democracy as well. I think we need to remember that parties are, like many other things that humans get involved in, a mechanism for building consensus. And that's important, I think, and, you know, that's something that I support. But I think that doesn't mean that, you know, and it's certainly there shouldn't be an expectation that elected representatives are some sort of robots and warm bodies then that are controlled by parties. You know, parties are ultimately made up of grassroots members, people on the ground, people in my community who have put their trust in me to be the party representative, so another mechanism for consensus making. And so, you know, but I think that if you don't have that loyalty to your constituency first, you don't get to have the privilege of continuing to represent your party because you won't get re-elected.
Bridget, there are a number of crossbenchers these days, some quite independent, in the Senate the same, in the House of Reps, the group are often called the Teals or Teal-like candidates, and all seem to be driven by this need to represent their community. And I sense the same, well, more than sense it, you're articulating a very similar proposition. Is it something that's worrying, do you think, the major parties, the Labor Party on the one side, the Coalition, Liberal and Nationals on the other, are the fact that people like you are exercising independent judgment backed by your communities? Is that something that's getting through? Is it likely that the parties will respond and adapt?
I hope so. I hope so, because I think part of what I guess it's not my main aim, but I suppose one of the things that I have tried to demonstrate is that is another possible way, you know, and in fact it's historically, I think, the way that parties did operate. And somewhere along the way, I think we've become confused with this notion of discipline and party discipline, if you like, is important, and unity, which is important. But that is not the same thing as having a different opinion. And actually, disagreement, at some point, disagreement has become a dirty word, when actually disagreement is really necessary. It's necessary in all of the interactions I think we have with each other as human beings as well, because it's what actually drives progress ultimately. And sometimes it, you know, stops people from perhaps making ill-considered choices or whatever, if someone says to them, often someone that they care about, not someone who is disunified or disloyal, but if someone that you care about says, do you think that's a good idea? Do you want to have a think about that? Perhaps we could look at it this way. Have you considered that? Those are good and positive values that have somehow been overlooked when we talk about this notion of discipline and unity. Now, I can see how we arrived at that point, because you had this sort of period of, I guess, political upheaval with changes of prime ministers and whatever, and everybody's like, well, we need discipline and we need unity. You do, but you also need to make space for divergent views everywhere, you know. Now, I think if the net result of not doing that has meant that some people have said, oh, well, the party system's not for me and I'm going to go over there and be a crossbench or, you know, an independent and try to do politics differently, which is good, fine. Like, I think independents are an important part of the democratic system. But I think it would be a mistake to think that it's a sort of you know, an either-or situation. I think parties and parties of government, when they work properly, are useful vehicles for consensus making. I also think that, you know, I have some concerns, I guess, around the kind of, not necessarily the rise in independence, but the consequences of that when you're in a situation, which we haven't seen much in this parliament, in the lower house at least, where there's no balance of power held by the crossbench, for example. But it does concern me that if we're in a situation where there is balance of power held by, you know, crossbench, for example, if that works as it should and you get sort of negotiated outcomes, consensus building, that's the parliament working at its best, no problem necessarily. But is that in practice how it works? Or is there potential then that you see, as we have seen at other points in time, a kind of horse trading, if you like, that occurs, that's, you know, one individual member being able to say to the government, well, I will give you my support, which may be the instrumental vote on that issue, in return for something that may or may not actually even be related to the matter that is being decided. And I do think that that is a bit problematic and potentially somewhat anti-democratic in a way, because who is that? Who's the, you know, who, I would say to the community, who are you happy, who are you comfortable with being the kingmaker, if you like? And I think that that is the potential danger, I suppose, of having a, you know, an increase in independent without knowing, well, who's going to be the decider in that case.
Bridget, you often hear it said on the street by people who take a passing interest, sometimes a bit more in politics, but they're not directly involved, that the trouble with having too many crossbenches is you don't have strong government. You know, they don't like these smaller parties or these independents coming along. But from what you've just said, a good government at least isn't compromised by having people who comprise a crossbench, whether it's in the upper house or the lower house.
No, I don't think that's the case, you know, and I think it, you know, it can be, you know, it can be workable, I guess. I mean, in Tasmania, in my home state of Tasmania at the moment, for example, we have a Liberal minority government who is having to negotiate with the crossbench. And, you know, so far that's holding, you know, that's holding. And there is that negotiation going on. So, you know, I think it can be workable. I think where I just have those concerns is that if you continue to have sort of an expanded crossbench and you get to that situation where one of those people, for example, gets to decide on a piece of legislation that comes forward, who's that person going to be and what are they going to extract in return for their support on something? Now, it's easy for us to say, you know, if that results in an outcome that we like, whoever we are and whatever we like, it's easy for us to say, well, that's all right, then that's a good outcome. But I suppose I would urge people to consider, well, what happens if that's held by somebody that whose views might not be what you like, or who's what they're trading off for their support in return for something is not what you think is the way forward, and the other 150 members of the House are sort of sidelined, I guess, in return for the vote of that one person. I don't know how comfortable I am with that.
I think another one of the propositions that would be advanced by, again, each side of politics with the major parties is that when it comes to policy formation, they have quite sophisticated well-established structures within the organisations by which policies developed. And it would be said, well, you, Bridget Archer, and everybody else who's a member, you've got, as party members do, ample opportunity to put into the various committees and groups analysing and producing a policy. And once it's been agreed upon, one should stick by it. But then I think on the other side of the coin from what you've been saying, you come back to your electorate. And people say, well, I'm also the representative for North Tasmania. And presumably you don't turn your ears off to what your local community is saying on any given point. So how do, in a sense, do you reconcile those two? But more importantly, how do you gather information when you aim to be the representative for the people of Northern Tasmania?
Well, I think you gather information in all sorts of ways. Obviously, being active in your community is the main way to do that. So go out into your community and ask people, listen to what they say. I mean, you can undertake more formal processes to survey people, for example, about what they think. But I think if you go out and talk to them and listen to what people are saying, and listen to what they're actually saying, I suppose. I mean, a good example of this was at the time that Helen Haynes moved the bill around a Federal Integrity Commission that I supported. People said to me then, well, nobody's saying that, I'm not in my community hearing people say I really want a Federal Integrity Commission. You can't mean to tell me that people in Bass are telling you we must have a Federal Integrity Commission. I said, no, they're not saying that. But what they're saying over and over and over again is, oh, well, why should I bother? I don't trust any of them. Why would I vote? All politicians are the same. So when you're listening, if you're actually listening to what they're saying, they're reflecting to you over and over and over again a declining trust in the institutions of government, of the parliament, whatever. And that, to me, that was a very clear idea that something needed to happen to try and circumvent that, to restore public trust and confidence. And that was really alarming to me because at the time, we had a pandemic where we needed people to have trust in government, and they probably had the lowest level of trust or declining levels of trust. So, no, they weren't saying that they particularly wanted a Federal Integrity Commission, but they were saying, I don't trust any of you, and I want to see something that's going to restore that. So I think it's about listening to what people are saying and interpreting that for a solution, I suppose, is part of that. Because I think that often where we're going to have those divergences of opinion is not necessarily on the problem. It's on the way to fix the problem or the solution to the problem. So I think there's that. And I think going to your first, I think the first premise of where you started, I think also goes to what's led to part of this problem around, parties, if you like, or this perception about parties, because if those mechanisms that exist for individual members to have contributions or make their contributions to policy development and bringing those policies to fruition on the way through, have those mechanisms to provide you to have a genuine say on that, a meaningful contribution, the ability to have your view heard, but also for it to move a position, not just based on, well, more of us, and I think this is what has happened over time, is that I think once upon a time it would have been, well, there's a range of views here. How do we get the most number of people in here as far down the road as they need to go? So a consensus, as opposed to what I think happens a lot now across, party lines, which is more of us think this, and so that's what we're going to do. And if you're a dissenting kind of voice, or if you say, well, hang on, that's really bad for my electorate, there's a chance that that it'll be, oh, well, there's more of us that think this, so we're going to do that. That's going to always be a problem because some communities are going to be, you know, heard more than others. There's a lot of variables to that. And I don't think that's a kind of genuine consensus making, if you like. And I don't think that's how a party can work or a parliament can work at its best. But I think that in part that's sort of what's happened. Again, in my party, we still then have the mechanism, you get into the party room and you still don't feel like your constituency has been heard, or you can't come to terms with the, you know, resolved position, that you can say, look, I'm going to sort of resolve, you know, reserve my right on this one. I can't come to terms on that. Which is perfectly reasonable. That's perfectly reasonable. That is part of that mechanism, I guess, to say, well, even with everyone's best efforts and best intentions, sometimes I think you're going to have those issues where you're like, well, I just can't get behind that for whatever reason. And that's actually fine. You know, I think we're in this increasingly polarised environment where we like to really construct conflict as well, even beyond what does exist. So I think there's been that little bit of a perfect storm of things that has then in some ways led to some people saying, well, the party system's not for me, I'm going to go over there, whereas I would sort of try to argue to people, if you want to change that, the best way to do that's to stay and bring your friends.
You were elected first in 2019, and then
I've got a ringing bell. I'm afraid, Michael.
You're going to have to go. Well, it sounds
I do have to go for a ringing division bell, I'm afraid.
In which case, we can't have you crossing the floor by your absence. We'll have to let you go.
All right.
Bridget, it has been a lovely conversation, and we've covered a lot. I was going to ask you how you found your time in Parliament, but I'm thinking you've been enjoying yourself and dealing and engaging with all the issues that have come your way. So I just want to thank you this morning for joining me on the podcast and wish you luck.
Thanks very much for having me. I look forward to talking to you again soon, Michael.
Okay. Thanks very much. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye.